Hello, my name is Norman Jackson. I'm the Director of Surrey Centre for Excellence in Professional Training and Education at the University of Surrey. I'm talking to Professor John Cowan about some of his experiences in engaging students in learning, something that John has been passionate about for over 40 years. John is well known in UK higher education as an expert teacher who has thought deeply about his practice. He is, if he doesn't mind me saying, a wise old owl. He's also an expert storyteller, and he's kindly agreed to let us record some of his stories so that other higher education teachers might benefit from his experiences and insights.
In 1971, there was a book published by two men called Postman and Weingartner, which got me into terrible trouble when the Cold War was on. If I was on education development work abroad, I used to take with me four or five books that I thought might be of use and interest to the people that I would be visiting. Sometimes I left a copy with them. And these would be on the top of my luggage. And I remember going into Czechoslovakia at the height of the Cold War, and they opened my suitcase, and here was this book, and the title was Teaching as a Subversive Activity. And obviously the guy who opened my case could read English and was very doubtful about the kind of subversive literature I was bringing in. Anyway, this book had a great impact on me. It's well worth reading even nowadays, if you can overlook the fact that all the teachers and all the students, as I recall it, were male. It was a bit sexist in that sense. It didn't recognise that there were females around. But it's a good book, and it's got some bad language in it. They talk about crap detectors are one way of sanitising your teaching, finding out what's in there that shouldn't be there. But one of the things that made a big impact on me was that they talked about the importance of the questions that people ask. And that resonated with me because I thought to myself, I really value people who ask good questions. One of the biggest compliments I can ever pay to anyone is to say, that's a good question. That's me being really complimentary. And equally, if I'm describing somebody in positive terms, I'm describing them in positive terms if I say, they're the kind of people who see and ask good questions. They ask pointed questions and so on. And so I was quite enthusiastic about this book. I enthused about it to one or two colleagues and other people. And then suddenly I thought to myself, John, you hypocrite. Here you are, all these years, not just when you read this book, believing that question-asking people are the kind of people that you want to produce as graduates. And what do? You set exam papers and assignments where you ask the questions and where they answer them. And they're answering people, the students, they're not questioning people at all. And I thought, really, we've got to establish a question asking culture. So the first thing I did was I introduced a new kind of, I can't call it an exam question, let's call it an exam task. I introduced a new kind of exam task in which I found a paper which was maybe two or three pages long and which the students should be able to understand, but which was about subject matter that hadn't featured in their course. And I gave it to them in what my colleagues called an examination. And what I did was I said to them, take plenty of time to read the paper and so on and so forth. What I want to know is, if you had access to the people who wrote that paper, what three questions would you ask? And why do you think they're worth asking? And that was the task. What three questions would you ask? And why do you think they're worth asking? And that separated the good question-asking people from the people that weren't so good at asking questions. And it's still an assessment task of which I must say I'm very proud, and I do feel it's very useful and very realistic because it relates to an ability that matters in real life. In professional life, the good professional person is the person who sees the questions that need to be asked of a client, a problem, a possible solution, and so on. They see the questions that haven't been asked yet, that haven't been thought about yet. So I tried another activity. And this was in the days when students studied a programme for a year. And in the first year programme, they all did the same subjects. And so I had probably more flexibility than you would have nowadays in the modular culture. And what I did was, we had a crush area, and in the crush area there was a notice board. And I told the students in September that if they wanted to pass the course, this was an absolute condition for passing the course, they had to have a question on the notice board in the crush area, which was about civil engineering, which was worth asking, and which no one in the first year knew the answer to. I pinched this idea from a journalism class in Australia, where a guy said to his first year class that if you want to pass this course, you must have had something published by the end of the year. And first of all, students started writing pretentious things which were rejected by editors. And eventually they started writing letters to newspapers and so on, so that they would get something published before the end of the year. He never actually failed anyone, but the students learned quite a lot about getting something published. Well, my students were going to learn quite a lot about questions. So there were questions which began to appear on the board. And if a first year student knew the answer to a question, they wrote the answer. They got some bonus marks for it, and after about a week we took that card down, and the person who had put that card up had to find another question. So by December we had a notice board that was full of questions, which prompted a great deal of interest from second, third and fourth year students, from members of staff, and sometimes from students in other departments who were walking through the crush area, because it was a throughway as well. Now, over the Christmas holidays, I took the cards down and I marked them as one-person questions or two-person questions or three-person questions. And then I put them back on the notice board and I invited bids from single students or pairs or trios to go away and find the answer to that question for the first year. And I accepted the first bid that came in and we took that card down. And of course, not all the cards received bids, because there were some two-person ones and some three-person ones. And we showed them how to find answers to questions, but how to use the library, how to use the, well, in those days it wasn't the internet, how to use journals and so on. We showed them how to do that, but we didn't help them to answer your question. We showed them how to find answers to questions generally. And that's what they worked on in the second term for part of the scheduled time. And then in the third term, we collected together questions which had something in common, and we would have presentation sessions with three or four or five presentations, and we advertised them. And what you had to do was you had to go to the presentation session with your own question in it, the question that your group had found an answer for, and half of the others. So you would expect that perhaps for some of the drearier groups of questions that the audience wouldn't be very large from a class of 130. And you would expect that for some of the more interesting questions, the audience would be rather larger. Now, usually when I'm talking about this to an audience, I say, I don't want you to say anything out loud, but could you just think in your mind, what do you think would be the biggest audience that would turn up for one of those presentation sessions? Remember, a first year class of 130, they only have to go to half the presentations. Allow a wee gap for people to think about it. And then I would say, for the best ones, we got over 250, 300 people turned up in an enormous lecture theatre. And we didn't have that many undergraduates in the department. There were undergraduates who came from other departments, there were members of staff who came, there were research teams who came, because the questions had interested them, they'd seen them on the notice board, and they wanted to know what the answers were. So I felt that was quite motivating for the students who'd found the answers. Incidentally, when they'd presented their answers, the answers were examinable in the end of year examination, so that helped as well. The answers were usually very erudite, much more erudite than normal first year material. But there was one spin-off from this, which was a problem. And the problem emerged the following year in a staff room conversation in which one of my colleagues, a retired colonel from the army, protested in strenuous terms that I had really created all sorts of trouble with the current second year class. That was the first year class who'd had this experience. And I said, what's the trouble? I was really... Okay. Well, I was quite pleased with that until the students moved on to the second year. And when I got to the second year, we were having a staff room conversation about halfway through the first term. And one of my colleagues, a retired colonel from the army, said in very retired colonel terms that I'd created all sorts of trouble with the present second year. And I was quite perturbed by that. And I said, what kind of trouble have I created? He said, well, in my lectures, they keep asking questions. And I said, are they trivial questions, George? And he said, no, they're not. They're usually very deep questions. They're the kind of questions that I don't want to answer in a second year class. I don't want to answer until we get to the fourth year, because they're deep and profound. And I didn't really regard that as negative feedback. So I think what I'm saying is that there's a big payoff in introducing a question-asking culture, but you're going to have to change the way you assess, you're going to have to change learning and teaching activities, you're going to have to change your learning outcomes. If you value question-asking, well, then you've got to go for the whole thing.
John entered academia after a successful career as a structural engineering designer. He developed pioneering academic programmes at Heriot Watt University, Edinburgh, where he was the first Professor of Engineering Education in the UK. His research focused on student learning and the student's learning experience. His passion and interest in student-centred learning now spans over 40 years. During that time, he's placed an ever-increasing emphasis on preparing students to exercise stewardship over their life-wide development while at university and in lifelong learning thereafter. In retirement, he remains an active teacher at Edinburgh Napier University in undergraduate and postgraduate studies. In reviewing John's book on becoming an innovative teacher, Professor John Biggs wrote, "A delightful and unusual reflective journey. The whole book is driven by a cycle of questions, examples, strategies, and generalizations from the examples. In all, it's the clearest example of practice what you preach that I have seen." Sceptre is fortunate indeed that John has offered to share his experience and wisdom with us through this series of podcasts, which reveal why he believes and does the things he does.